All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I was a Chief Warrant Officer helicopter pilot during the Vietnam conflict, war, rebellion, whatever you want to call it, 1969 with the 195th Assault Helicopter Company. Welcome to Veterans Radio. We're very pleased and happy to have you here with us today. If you want to get in on the conversation, we invite you to give us a call at 734-822-1600. At 734-822-1600, or you can call us toll free at 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET-1600. Well, we've got a really interesting program today. We're going to be talking with a gentleman named Bob Dvorak, who was an AP correspondent during the first Gulf War with the 82nd Airborne, and he's kept a journal his entire time that he was in Iraq at the time. And as he mentions in the book, you know, he said you can't write about a war when you're in the war. So he has kept his journal, and he finally got out putting it all together. And it makes a great story. And he's also asking about, of course, what is going on today in the world. And we're going to be hopefully discussing that a little bit later on in the program. So I want you to stick around for that. He's got a book called Drive On, The Uncensored War of Bedouin Bob and the All-Americans. It's kind of an interesting title, and I'll let him explain what all that means when he comes on in just a moment. But there are some events that are happening. Number one is our Fisher House of Michigan. And for those of you that are not familiar with what a Fisher House is, it's housing for veterans and their families at local VA hospitals. And there are a number of them around the country, but there are none of them in Michigan. So an organization has begun, and we've gotten approval by the National Fisher House. You can go to fisherhousemichigan.org and make your donation. And next week, we're going to have representatives from Fisher House Michigan on the program to tell us all about what they're hoping to do near the VA here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So it's going to be the first Fisher House in Michigan. So put that down on your calendar for the 14th. I realize that that's Mother's Day. It's kind of an appropriate thing because we're going to provide home for the families and veterans that are utilizing the Ann Arbor VA facilities. As you may know, it gets pretty crowded around Ann Arbor, Michigan, especially during the fall, during football season, when all of the hotels and motels are all booked up and their prices tripled. And, you know, it's difficult for people to receive care and, you know, stay anywhere nearby. So we want to make sure that you tune in next week to learn all about the Fisher House, Michigan. The other thing is, of course, our local Yankee Air Museum is getting it all geared up for their Thunder over Michigan. And that's coming up in September over Labor Day weekend, and they're going to have the United States Navy Blue Angels there this year, which is cool. I don't know if any of you have ever been out to Willow Run and seen Thunder over Michigan, but I was out there a couple of years ago with the Air Force. I forget what they're called right now, but their jet team. And as we were driving up to Willow Run, the jets flew directly over the car, and the whole car shook. And my grandson was just freaking out about what in the world was that all about. So put it on your calendar, Labor Day this year, the Yankee Air Museum's Thunder Over Michigan, September 2nd through 4th. You can go to their website, that's yankeeairmuseum.org, for more information, and you can get discounts on your tickets if you start picking them up a little bit early. The last thing about I wanted to mention real quickly was that the Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America, the Michigan chapter, I guess is what it's called, is sponsoring a Vet Together at the Plymouth VFW, that's Plymouth, Michigan VFW, this coming Wednesday, the 10th of May, from 6 to 7. So we want you to register for this event, and they're asking, let's tell what's going to be at the event. Okay. They're going to be discussing She Was Born in the Battle campaign and the Deborah Sampson Act and how you can get involved. They're going to discuss the threats to the GI Bill for active duty military members. They're also going to talk about a little bit about what this change in the health care laws may do to veterans' tax credits, I guess is what the term I'm looking for. It may affect not people that are getting VA care, but people who are qualified for VA care but are not taking it. So you might want to check this out. And Rebecca Couch is going to be there, and she knows everything. She's part of the Homefront Strong Resilience Program for post 9/11 spouses and significant others. And so we suggest that you do this. This is at the Plymouth VFW on 10 May from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. And they ask that you register for the event. And okay, have you got your pen out? Okay, good. So it's under my period. iava.org/COV. And I'll put this up on our website later on for you to look, but it's Iraq, Afghanistan, Veterans of America.org/COV, or you can look for their events on that page, and I think that you'll be able to find some help there. I think this is a great opportunity. Shannon Adams is the community leader for the Michigan, Iraq, Afghanistan, Veterans of America, and he's going to be on. I think it's 2 weeks. We're going to have him on to talk about all the programs that are going to be going on around Michigan and how you can become more involved, especially if you did serve during the Iraq-Afghanistan conflicts. These organizations are really very helpful. As a member of the VVA, Vietnam Veterans of America 310, it's a great opportunity for you to go and talk with men and women who served at the same time you did in. I still find it very helpful to talk to these people that, went through similar situations that we did. So check out all three of those things. That's the Yankee Air Museum for Thunder Over Michigan, the Fisher House, Michigan, and the Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America program that's coming up this Wednesday. So check out the Plymouth, Michigan VFW on Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Okay. Now we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with today's guest, who is Bob Dvorak. His book is Drive On, and the question we're asking today, for those of you who don't know why we're doing this, is America going to war? Should we? I don't know. We'll be right back to see if we can solve this problem. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Like today, we pass the time away, writing love letters in the sand.
Okay, I chose that song. Actually, I chose the album because I just received it in the mail this week. It is Christy Lane, and I don't know any of you Vietnam veterans that may be familiar with that name, is that she was an entertainer with the USO that was in Vietnam quite often. Especially during 1969, I never actually saw her in person, but I was sent a CD by her organization, and it's a salute to the VFW. And there are all kinds of songs and on here about, that were popular during 1969. And so I encourage you to check out Christy Lane, the C-R-I-S-T-Y, and she was inducted into the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall of Fame. Pretty cool. So we're going to hear some of her music during breaks today. Okay. Joining me on the line right now is our guest is Bob Dvorak, who is a veteran, and I'll talk about that in a minute. The war correspondent author, his recent book is Drive On, The Uncensored War of Bedouin Bob and the All-Americans. And he actually was embedded with the 82nd Airborne during the Gulf War I, the All-Americans. And he lived with the paratroopers prior to and during the invasion of Iraq. He had worked for 44 years as a journalist with the Uniontown Newspapers Incorporated, Associated Press, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and has received awards for writing. But he said his biggest award was being honorably. Bob, I'll ask you. You became a member of the 82nd Airborne, right?
That's right. Honorary member of Bravo Company, the Nasty Boys, 2nd Battalion, 325th. Airborne Infantry Regiment. Going to see those guys later this month during All American Week.
I want to talk about that a little bit later on. I also want to introduce you to our audience as probably the unluckiest person in the world, only from the standpoint of this guy was the last had the last draft number in the lottery during the Vietnam era, and got caught in it.
And naturally lucky, I guess. Yeah, absolutely. It was, the war was over. But they still needed draftees for the ranks because they're going to the all-volunteer force.
Right.
So I got the notice in the mail. Greetings from Richard M. Nixon, and ended up in the draft. So, but I and you'll find this interesting. My oldest brother was also a draftee, and he was in Nam 68-69 with the Air Cavalry Troop of the 11th ACR. So,
he was up in where was he?
Swanlock.
Swanlock. That's right. Yeah. The black horse.
Black Horse Cav. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I was in that area at the same time in 1969. I was drafted also, and we had a little party when they had the first lottery in 1969. And I came out with number 113.
Uh-huh.
And so we said, "Uh-oh, they're going to draft me and send me to Nam."
And you're right on the cusp. You probably 113. That's just low enough to get the notice, right?
Yeah. I'd already gotten my letter, but mine was from LBJ.
So. Yeah.
So anyway, so you were in the service for what? For 2 years?
They didn't need bodies like mine without a war on. So I finished up in the reserve. So mm-hmm. I was active for a while, and I transitioned to the reserves. That's where I finished up.
Okay. All right. So tell me, how did you get involved in journalism?
Well, that's a very serendipitous thing too. I was in high school. I got a scholarship to go to academic scholarship to go to college at Penn State at a local campus, and the local paper was looking for somebody that was good in English and going to the Penn State campus, and I got a job at a newspaper 10 days after graduation from high school. So I've been a reporter since I was 17. Actually it was the college commitment that got me a deferment, until a little later on. So, that worked out that way. And I just couldn't believe that people would pay you to write stories for a living. Cause my old man was a World War II vet in the Navy. He grew up on a farm in, southwestern Pennsylvania. The youngest of nine kids of, immigrant farmers. So, I never thought of us as a military family. I always thought of us as an American family. But my dad, my oldest brother, and then me, saw service. And, I went back to, Iraq for Desert Storm, as a reporter and ended up with the 82nd Airborne Division again. So, that was quite a trip. Makes a good book, doesn't it? Makes a good story.
I think it's a great story. I haven't finished it, but I just got it yesterday.
And
So I was up reading, trying to catch up with things on it. But it's got so many great, things in here that about, your experiences. And I think let's go to that is how did you get to go to Iraq with the 82nd Airborne when you were with the Associated Press?
And you talked about lucky. At the time, in the august minds of the Pentagon and the news organization said, well, there's going to be so many reporters here, we can't possibly take them all out into the field. They'll be running all over each other. So they took just a select number, and that was about 36 36 of us, who got assigned to pools that were hooked up with units, combat units, Marines, Army, Air Force, Navy. And I was Army combat pool number one, and I was on a bus, and they called my name and said, you're with the 82nd Airborne Division. And I pumped my fist, and I said, oh, this is great. This will be great. it was just pure luck of the draw. But I couldn't have picked a better unit to be assigned to be honest with you. Those guys are high speed.
Well, yeah, they certainly are. They were, and they still are even today. Where did you work prior to working with the Associated Press? And it sounds like you're from the Pittsburgh area.
Yes, I worked at my hometown newspaper, Uniontown Newspapers Incorporated, for 8 years. Then I got hired by the Associated Press. And I worked in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Harrisburg before being promoted to New York as a national writer. So I was based in New York City, and This is October of 1990, and one of our international guys had to come home for a family emergency, so they needed a replacement in Saudi Arabia, and the boss walked by one day and said, I want you to go cover the war. And me and my great enthusiasm said, for how long? 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years? And he said, whatever it takes. And I was on my way. First time I left the country, actually, because I never left the country when I was a draft, when I was in the Army.
Mm-hmm. So you flew over to Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, Dahran on the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Gulf. They can't even agree on what the name of the Gulf is, but it's on the Gulf side of things in the eastern province, and that's where the military had a joint information bureau. So I was there, and I actually during the buildup interacted with all branches of the service: the Marines, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Army, of course, and through Thanksgiving and Christmas and the build-up, and then first of the year in 1991, things got real quick.
Yes, they did. For those of you that were involved in that one, so was there a true coalition during the first Gulf War?
There was, actually. I mean, it's a little-known fact. This brigade of the 82nd Airborne was attached to a French light-armored division on the far western flank. So the French had a division that did some fighting. The British had their armored division that did some fighting. And it seems impossible to believe now, but actually Syria sent a division to Saudi Arabia in defense of that country. So the Syrians were on our side then, and now if you looked at it, let's see, we're bombing the government, and we're also bombing some of the rebels who aren't on our side to support the rebels who are on our side. So,
got it.
Yeah, it's complicated over there.
Everybody seems to try and simplify whatever is going on over there, but they never seem to quite get it right.
War is simple, but it's hard.
I think I've heard that comment recently. Anyway, so you were in Saudi Arabia, and you got to go out. Actually, went out into the field with these guys because on the cover of your book, we're talking with Bob Dvorak or Robert J. Dvorak. If you're looking for the book, but the book is called "Drive On: The Uncensored War of Bedouin Bob and the All Americans," and the picture shows a foxhole, your foxhole, evidently, on the last day you were there or the first day you were there?
This was the last day. This was after the ceasefire. But, that's my hole. And, of course, every Army basic trainee learns that you dig it a body length long and 3 feet wide and deep enough to get you in out of the wind. And you stack all the dirt on the long one side. So if a round comes in, it might absorb some shrapnel. You take a direct hit, there's nothing they can do, but all they have to do is shovel the dirt back on top of you because you dug your own grave.
That's a nice way of putting it.
What they called it the hasty grave. I know.
I don't remember. Well, and I was lucky. I was a pretend officer, so I didn't have to, do a lot of those things. My platoon, they made me platoon leader because I was the biggest. And that's the Army way of doing stuff. You know, the four biggest guys, we were the platoon leader and the squad leaders, and that was it. And so I just had to supervise the digging of these hasty graves, as you called them.
You can dig them in practice all you want, but when you have to dig one for real and you understand the gravity of your situation, I'm telling you, even if you come out of that unscathed, you're different. All the molecules get rearranged.
I know. We were. I was in a mortar attack, and I tried to dig a hole through asphalt. It didn't work
too
well.
Amazing how deep you can get, isn't it?
It is. It's me. I still can't get the stuff out of my nails. We're with the 82nd Airborne. And were they part of the first part of the invasion, or how did they get involved?
Well, if you go back to the beginning, the 82nd has a ready brigade. They're on call to go anywhere in the world within 18 hours of notification, right?
Mm-hmm.
The 2nd Brigade, who I ended up with, happened to be the Verde Brigade, so they went to Saudi Arabia to draw the original line in the sand. And this is 2,500 paratroopers against the world's fourth largest army and 4,000 tanks and 1,000 artillery pieces. And they called themselves originally, when they drew the line, until all the heavy stuff got over there, they called themselves speed bumps because they knew all they could do was slow them down. They wouldn't have been able to stop them. But, I mean, that's, again, that good old Army humor. Call yourself speed bumps. Then when the heavy stuff got there and they took over the front line, they pulled back and they were at a base in Abkhag. You never heard of it.
No.
But when they were going to go get liberate Kuwait, the brigade went up to a tactical assembly area just south of the Iraqi border, and we lived up there for 5 weeks, right on the edge of it. And you know, night patrols, night ambushes, Apache attack, helicopter attacks, and whatnot. And we actually, as the tip of the bayonet, invaded Iraq the day before the main ground assault. So I was inside Iraq before the invasion on the 24th.
Okay, so you
again lucky. Yes. Lucky.
Yeah. Well, it just the main luck, of course, is to be able to come home.
Yes.
From
yes,
those
I know
types
that.
Of things.
I know that. Yeah.
Well, and I know that this invasion of Iraq, or it wasn't really an invasion of Iraq. It was a pushback against Iraq, I think, more than anything else. I know that I have a nephew who was an Army Ranger and was in Iraq well before it was popular. Setting up antennas and all kinds of different things there for communication purposes. So it's can you, just for our audience's sake, and it's kind of interesting. I teach at a local community college, and I have students, you know, that are 18 and 19 years old, and they have no concept of what the first Gulf War was about.
Right, right.
So and maybe even our audience, we might have forgotten ourselves. So we got about 4 minutes, Bob, before we have to take a break at the bottom of the hour. Can you give us a little history lesson on what was going on and why we were there?
Right, and this was Iraq invaded Kuwait to take over its oil wells because it was in debt in its war against Iran, right, the eight-year war. So basically, they were going to hold, instead of robbing the bank, they just took over the bank. And George Bush, Bush 41, drew a line in the sand, said this isn't going to happen. Because if he got that much oil, no telling what he could do. So, and this was the biggest buildup since Vietnam. The American Army and an international coalition was sent to Saudi Arabia, the home of Islam, to defend that country and its oil interests, and then to liberate Kuwait. But one of the things that gets lost, and I think even in and those who were in the military, how big this operation was. You know, that battlefield was 300 miles long. It was the length of Pennsylvania. And if you think about the Marines attacking north into Philadelphia, and we with the French were out in Pittsburgh, and the tanks rolled in through Harrisburg, there was a lot of things in motion all at the same time.
That is very true, your 300-mile thing. Because I'm from New Jersey originally, and so we drive to New Jersey constantly, and every time we hit the border of Pennsylvania, and we know we have 306 miles to go until we get to Bellefonte, which is halfway.
Yes. Take a nice little break. It's a drive.
It's a long state, but the idea of a 300-mile battlefront is pretty serious. And I know that that President Bush had been warning, you know, and telling Hussein, you know, back off, or we're going to come in and, you know, take care of you. He didn't back off.
He did. I don't think he ever believed that that we would go through with this. This is, you know, that we wouldn't risk American lives for this kind of an endeavor. And he was wrong. It was the biggest, like one of them said, it was the biggest poker game in the world. And Bush called him. And so you take four armored divisions and three lighter divisions and a couple Army cavalry regiments and two Marine divisions, and the Air Force, the Navy, and they put it all together. They really did. It was, when you talked about overwhelming force, I mean, this was the air land battle dark doctrine in motion. It was really impressive.
Well, yeah, and it seemed to work.
Yeah, in 100 hours, they said. Although the genius who came up with 100-hour war never spent a day in a desert, I can tell you that right now.
Well, that's why I played the song about all the sand. I couldn't think of it.
The sand, yeah. Yeah, they called it, the paratroopers called it the sandbox. I mean, you could call it the world's largest kitty litter, the world's largest ashtray, or whatever else. It was just this sea of desolation that and you get in the middle of it, and you feel like the smallest thing in the face of the earth.
Well, I'm sure, and you're probably still pulling sand out of places you didn't even know you had.
Exactly.
Well, we need to take a break, so hold on the line, please, Bob.
Will do.
Okay. We're talking with Bob Dvorak, author of Drive On, a correspondent with the AP who was with the 82nd Airborne during their first Gulf War. Come on back after the news, and you can ask a question. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
For spacious skies, for amber waves of green, for purple mountains, majesties above the fruited plain.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. Again, that's Christy Lane and her album, Salute to the VFW. Our guest is Bob Dvorak. He's the uncensored war of Bedouin Bob and the All-Americans. His book is Drive On. And I was just reading during the break, how did you get the name Bedouin Bob?
Well, that comes from a major in the Airborne. He was my escort and my guide for much of it. And he was amazed at how quickly I took to the desert and how quickly my army training returned to me, you know, living out in the field. The Bedouins are the nomads of the desert, the Arabs who have done this for thousands of years and make a living, you know, in the middle of the desert. So Bedouin Bob became my war name. And, of course, the All-Americans, that's the name that was given to the 82nd during World War One. When somebody noticed that their ranks were filled with members from all the states in the Union, so they became the All-Americans.
Okay, well, that explains that. You
Oh, in the uncensored part, while I was there, I just signed a paper. Yeah. I was under operational security. I couldn't say where we were, what we were going to do. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all military secrets. So I could write generic stories, but not specific ones. When I came back and got back to the rear and, you know, the war was over and everybody was going home, nobody wanted to hear the details. So I've been carrying this around in the rucksack for 26 years. So I just needed to get it out.
I'm glad that you did. And there are so many stories like this that are out there, I'm sure, that we don't know. It's kind of like, it's almost like the forgotten, you know, like Korea almost. It's like the forgotten war because of the ongoing 15 years that we've been involved in Iraq and Afghanistan the second time, it seems like. You also mentioned in the book the idea of the change in the public's attitude toward the military and all of the politicians especially saying, oh, the Vietnam era is over, you know, that has been lifted off of the military's shoulders. What do you think about that?
Well, and that's one of the key you know, themes of the book is that, you know, after Vietnam, they had to rebuild, you know, and they went all volunteer with that philosophy and everything. But the cadre, the guts of the Army, were the combat officers and combat NCOs from Vietnam mm-hmm. who said, wait a minute, we're going to fix this. We're not going to make the same mistakes. We're not going to go in dribs and drabs. And, you know, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it the right way. And it was those guys who was really had put together the Army of 1990, and it was you know, President Reagan in that build up in the 80s that fortified the military again. So in many ways, I saw it as the last battle of Vietnam. And said, look, this is what we could do if we put all of our force together and we go at people with a plan and a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because I returned home with the 82nd. I was the only reporter on that flight, his third flight home, and went back to Bragg. And the reception that these guys got, both in New York City and back at Fort Bragg, and the support of the American people, who I think really had this guilt trip from what happened in Nam, is how they didn't separate the war from the warrior, and somehow, for the only time in American history, soldiers, people in the military, were blamed for a policy that they didn't.
We don't have anything to do with policy making.
Yeah, we enforce the policy. We don't create the policy, and it really was a falling back in love with the military on the part of America, and that's still evident today. I think people support the troops. You just scratch their heads and wonder, what the heck, what are we doing now?
Right. Do you think that was because George W. Bush was a veteran himself, that he didn't want to get tied down into something again?
I give him props for, he was a pilot in the Pacific in World War II, and he got shot down. Now, somebody who crosses the line of departure and actually gets into this stuff has certainly a different perspective on the gravity of these situations other than somebody who does not. So I think he really did appreciate it. But I do think it was a spontaneous grassroots thing. And I think a lot of the Vietnam guys supported the troops in Saudi Arabia in Desert Storm so much because they knew how much it meant. It would really, soldiers can fight wars, can fight battles, but it's the American public that wins them. If you don't have the support of the American public, you're not going to do diddly, right?
Yeah, it's just going to go on and on, and unfortunately, I think that's appears to be what happens. There were many critics of George W. Bush, stopping the quote the invasion of Iraq and not going in and taking out Saddam at that point.
Yes, and actually we're convinced we're going straight to Baghdad and just shut that guy up. Or why else would we have been there? I can tell you this, if they'd have gone another 12 hours, they would have annihilated every one of those guys in the field. Now, the point was, they had liberated Kuwait, so that was the objective, instead of marching on to Baghdad, and he called it mission creep or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And Colin Powell said, well, there's still chivalry in war. They stopped it so there wouldn't become a wholesale slaughter out there in the sands. And of course, and the consideration was, well, if we take this guy out, this is the Middle East, is there going to be something worse behind him than what we can deal with now? And ask yourself, would it be easier to deal with Saddam Hussein right now or ISIS?
I don't know, but I think that probably ISIS is sort of an indirect result of not going in and taking him out.
Yes, but only after, you'd have a bloody religious civil war with the Sunnis and the Shiites.
Yeah, and that's you point that out in your book very well, I think, is the idea of, for some reason, our politicians never seem to quite get it through their head that these people have been fighting each other for thousands of years.
Oh, 1,400 years, right?
And it's not going to change.
And you remember the line from Patton, he said, the politicians, they always leave us with another war to fight. Mm-hmm. And so few people, I think, realize, the military doesn't make these decisions. We're under civilian control.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was, well, we don't want the military to go off starting wars, but shouldn't there be some kind of litmus test for the civilian authorities on when to start these things, when to stop them? So,
it's interesting, and I encourage people to read the book. It's a drive on by Bob Dvorak, and the post first Gulf War is interesting. Listening to all of the politicians, explaining why they didn't want to get involved in, going into Baghdad and, getting more and more and more involved in what was going on in the Middle East. And then we fast forward to 9/11, and it's many of the same politicians saying, oh, now we got to go in and take these guys out.
Dick Cheney was the one who said, don't go to Baghdad. It's not worth any more American lives. Then he changed his mind and said, let's go to Baghdad and take him out. And it's 9/11 did change a lot of things in the mentality. I know that. It was such a devastating day for me. One, to know that we had been attacked and lots of American lives. And then two, there would be military campaigns, and I thought we'd just wipe out entire populations. We still might. It's one of those things. But here we are. I mean, we've been in Afghanistan for 16 years, and that's now become the longest war in American history, longer than Nam. And we're back in Iraq for the third time with, special forces, Rangers. There's some paratroopers from the 82nd back in around Mosul. And they're in Syria and Afghanistan and Yemen and Libya. And
they're everywhere. We're everywhere.
I don't know if you saw it. There was the Army general in charge of Special Operations Command testified before Congress this week and said, look, I got 8,000 troops in 80 countries, and we can't sustain this. We can do wonderful things, incredible things, but we can't solve every problem in the world. And it's they're straining the force, which is the sad part of it.
I know these men and women, you know, are doing so many multiple tours, and you know what was it? That's unfortunate. A special forces person was killed in Somalia.
You know,
this week, and it's everywhere. We can talk politics forever.
I know.
I want to get back to your book a little bit and talk about some of the characters that you ran, that you were out in the sand with. And I guess I can ask you one really sad story that you mentioned was the Scud missile that hit the base in Saudi Arabia.
And that was it hit a building that I had been by a couple of times during my time over there, and I'm at the front line, like 400 or 500 miles to the north, and I'm watching A-10s take out tanks, and we've invaded Iraq, and everybody's driving through, and then that night this one Scud missile leaks through, hits that building, and 14 reservists from Greensburg, Pennsylvania unit just get obliterated in a flash. And it reminds you of the randomness of these endeavors. You could be sitting on your cot playing Trivial Pursuit, and and you get blown up, and somebody out on the front line is like me, is going through without getting a scratch. And that always stuck with me, the timing of that.
It is always amazing when you think of how close you've been to death, and yet you're still walking around.
Yeah, there's an old saying in the airborne: you haven't lived until you come close to death, and that's, I think, for all of us who come back, that's the truth.
We certainly do appreciate life much more than we did before. But the thing is, and what I was thinking about in reading that chapter of when you go back to Pennsylvania. And you're talking about the families of these people, and this is the thing that many people don't understand. Yes, the soldier has been killed and is gone, but look what he's left behind. You know, to try and the spouse and the children and the parents trying to put their lives back together again after this person just, as you said, just disappears.
Right, and one of the real purposes of the book was to put a human face on it. Not just with the guys in the ranks and, doing the job, but the people back home. The wives, how many of them thought of their wives or the child that was born while they were away that they never got to see? And then, yes, the everlasting impact on a parent, on a spouse, on a child, to have their loved one just ripped out of their lives. It's like it's like the end of the world. It is the end of the world for them. And I don't know how or why we ever get away from that concept, but somehow we seem to inure ourselves to these things, that we're isolated from it, and we're not. Which brings us back to the composition of today's military, the 1% or the less than the 1%. If they're bearing the burden, and you don't have someone you know or some relative in the military, you know, what are you doing? You're out shopping at the mall and watching golf on TV and living and maybe worried about your job, but you know, you're certainly not thinking about the military conflicts in a very direct way.
No, it's not something that you know is at your forefront of thinking until you hear about somebody maybe local or possibly some relative that may have gotten wounded or killed. You know, it's fascinating to me that, you know, in times of war, I think that civilians especially, they get tired of it, and they move on to something else that grabs their attention.
In a way, I think they kind of get spoiled because, spoiled may not be the right word, but, you know, you have a military briefing and say, oh, this is what we're doing, it's going so well. Well, it's a little different outside that briefing room when you're down in the dirt with the grunts, and nothing's easy. Nothing gets done by itself, and what you see on TV and what you hear from the briefers is not necessarily the same thing as what's going on in the field. I'm sure you appreciate that from your service in Nam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do, and I appreciate in talking to you. And I've been fortunate enough to have quite a few Iraq-Afghanistan veterans in my classes. And, you know, like most of us, when we first get home, we're pretty reluctant to talk about it,
Yes.
You know, even you with writing your book.
Imagine that. I know why people are reluctant to talk about it. Unless you've been there, you don't understand, and you don't want to call attention to yourself. But in my shoes, it was my job to write about it. So if I didn't say it, I wouldn't have been doing my job. And, you know, I was torn by that for any number of years. And I will say one other thing. This book is, my co-publisher is, Tactical 16.
Well, I wanted to get into them.
let's talk about that.
Let's do talk about them. Cause in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, there's also an organization called the Military Writers Society. And, this is a group that I've been involved with for a number of years. And when I saw these guys, what they were doing, I was wondering if there was some sort of hookup there. Somehow. So tell me about this Tact 16.
This was an Iraq war vet who came back and was so, transformed by his experience that he thought the one way to help him heal from the trauma of that was to write a book, to get his thoughts down, to just unburden himself, and ended up forming his own publishing company, and it's been very successful. They encourage veterans. They encourage veterans to write, to express themselves as a way of healing, to get all this out. You know, don't bury it. Don't try to live with it alone. I sent them a proposal, and they jumped at it. And you can imagine, for me, for 26 years, I've been told by the conventional media, oh, we don't want to hear this. I got rejection slips.
Yeah.
We don't care about this. Nobody cares about this stuff anymore. But it was a military group that actually took up the project, and because they knew it's a way of healing wounds, the invisible wounds from war, the stuff that people carry around in their souls the whole time.
I think it's so important. I agree with you entirely, Bob, that this is what if veterans can do this, if they can't write it down, at least talk about it with other veterans.
Yes,
you know, civilians.
I really do think that's so important in the healing process, and it's not, listen, I'm not calling attention to myself or look how great I was because I did something. I wanted to preserve the names, the hometowns, and the faces of the people I met who actually did these things, and this was my tribute to them. Hey, it's Armed Forces Appreciation Month, right?
Right.
I wrote a whole book as an appreciation for the Armed Services of America.
Let's go back to that just for a moment. Tell me, you kept a journal of your entire time in Iraq and in the Middle East. And when you came back, you had difficulty getting your publisher or your boss to actually write your stories.
He was a Vietnam vet. That's what always just bugged the heck out of me. He's the one who told me to keep a journal. He sent me off to war, and he said, you know, he did two tours. And he said, you know, keep a journal because, you know, this is different from any assignment you're ever going to be on. And I did. And when I got back, it was like, I was in a war. I was in a real war. Now shut up and get back to work. And I really do think that he had some of these pangs. Wait a minute. I didn't get any attention when I came home, and you people were getting parades and everything else. And there was a little bit of that going on. But the guy did me a big favor. He gave me my story back, and 26 years later, I got to tell it. So yep. It works out in the end, doesn't it?
most things do, it seems like. The book is Drive On, The Uncensored Word of Bedouin Bob and the All-Americans, Robert J. Dvorak. I love that name. Somebody mentioned earlier when I said, oh, I got Bob Dvorak on my program. Isn't he a musician?
He wrote symphonies. He wrote the New World Symphony, and... From my old the old country back in Europe, he wrote symphonies. I played the radio. How's that?
There you go. That's my musical talent as well. I can do that. When we sent out our flyer for the program this week, we kind of entitled it the idea of Are We Going to War Again? And I wanted to ask you about that because that's what CJ sent to me. That's your agent, I'm assuming. Is America going to war, and should we? What do you think is going to happen in the next... We have 5 minutes to talk about this, and my assistant's waving her hands over there.
Yeah, now don't forget, we already are at war
right.
with these Islamic fanatics who, you know, cut your throat on TV. And that's been going on since 9/11, 2001. We're still in Afghanistan, and we're fighting in Iraq, Syria, and whatever. So we got that one going on. And these are against people that don't wear uniforms or don't go out on a
right.
battlefield in military formations. So it's a little fighting them in the cities. Now, you know, saber rattling with North Korea. There is a situation there where you cannot allow them to get a long-range missile that could reach the United States with a nuclear warhead. We all agree on mm-hmm. that, right? We have to protect, we have to defend ourselves from this existential
right.
threat. But, hey, that Korean War, the first one never ended. I mean, there was a ceasefire, but not a peace treaty. There's been a state of war on that peninsula since 1953, since 1950. So, again, you get into, our military isn't huge. I mean, it's powerful. It's packed with volunteers. You start spreading them around too thin, then you take away your strength, which is, you know, quick, decisive military action.
Right.
And get this stuff over with. And I just wish that we had a command sergeant major or a first sergeant who, when somebody said, well, look, we think we want to do this, to have somebody say, well, I got the guys who can do it for you. They'll fight like the third monkey on the ramp to Noah's Ark, and it's mm-hmm. starting to rain, but you're going to pay a price. And it's not just the immediate price. You better be able to take care of these people when they come home, too, because this is going to change them in ways that you can't even imagine.
That's right. I was reading in the paper today that the rumors are starting to fly about sending more troops back into Afghanistan, and I just kind of went, why?
Yeah.
What's the point of that?
That Kornigal Valley, I mean, you know, it's they just dropped the Moab, the mother of all bombs, and, you drop a, it's in the mountain ranges where, you know, there just aren't any population centers. So it's different. Yeah. And, I would just hope that we got some kind of situation report. You know, where's mm-hmm. the sit rep on this? Tell me who's out there and what we've got to do. And I would have a much better, comfort zone, into deciding what to do next. I just think that the notion that we have this all-powerful military, that's great. Real power is knowing when not to use it, and military power does have its limits. It cannot solve every political problem in the world, and I think people make the mistake of confusing those two things.
It's interesting that, you know, the quote that the real power is knowing when not to use it is by Robert McNamara, and we all, for those
exactly.
of us from the Vietnam
exactly.
era,
no,
we
I
all know
feel,
about.
I do feel... you know, with H.R. McMaster at mm-hmm. National Security, he was a troop captain in Desert Storm, and he fought the Republican Guard in the first engagement between American tanks and the Republican Guard. And Keith Kellogg was the chief of staff for the 82nd Airborne. is involved in the administration. Of course, you got Mad Dog Mattis. Those mm-hmm. guys who have been there, who got that CIB on their chest, they're the last ones in the world that want to go to war. But if they do have to go to war, they know to get it over with as quickly as possible.
I think that's what most people in the military know, that, you know, if you're going to do it fast and be done with it, and don't let it string out like it has. Bob, I'm hoping that you'll come back on the program. I've really enjoyed interviewing you and asking, you know, listening to your opinion, and especially reading your book. I think it's a great story. I encourage people to go out and grab this story. It's Drive On, the Uncensored Word of Bedouin Bob and the All-Americans, Robert J. Dvorak. Where can they get this?
You can get it at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or just contact me at bdvorak@msn.com, and I'll shoot you off an autographed copy. And as far as returning any time, I love talking about our military from the ground up rather than the top down, and I love talking about people who have been there and know what they're talking about. So anytime you want to have me back on, I'm at your disposal.
Thank you very much, Bob. And I'm going to end the program here in just a minute with a line that you're going to recognize probably from your book, Almost. All right, folks, thank you very much for tuning in to Veterans Radio this week. We will be back next week. We're going to be talking about the Fisher House, as I mentioned. And I've got a couple of World War II veterans that we're going to be having on in the next couple of weeks. So until next week, you are dismissed.